Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Betty Friedan, the feminist writer and activist acclaimed as the mother of second-wave feminism and path-breaking author of The Feminine Mystique, was powerful and polarizing. As a journalist, she covered racism, sexism, labor, class inequity, and anti-Semitism. As a wife and mother, she struggled to balance her work and homemaking. Her malaise as a housewife and her research into the feelings of other women resulted in The Feminine Mystique, which made her a celebrity. Using her influence, Friedan co-founded the National Organization for Women, the National Women's Political Caucus, and the National Association to Repeal Abortion Laws. She fought for the Equal Rights Amendment, universal child care, and workplace protections for mothers, but she disagreed with the women's liberation movement over sexual politics. Her volatility and public conflicts fractured key relationships. For this episode, we are pleased to discuss the full complexity and impact of Friedan with scholars Rachel Stier and Catherine Turk. Stier is the author of Betty Friedan, Magnificent Disruptor. Turk is the author of The Woman of Now, How Feminists Built an Organization that Transformed America. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Rachel and Catherine are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place August 25th, 2023, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Catherine and Rachel, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. Looking forward to learning about Betty Friedan from you both and having a good conversation. But before we get started, for our listeners, maybe you could just introduce yourselves a little bit and talk about any projects you have. And you both have books coming out soon, or one is already out and another one coming out soon. So I'd love to hear more about that. Katie, maybe you could start.
Well, thank you so much, Nate. It's wonderful to be here with you and Rachel. I'm an associate professor of history and adjunct associate professor of women's and gender studies at UNC Chapel Hill in North Carolina, where I teach courses on women, gender, sexuality, law, labor, social movements, and sometimes other stuff too. I just published my second book with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, which is called The Women of Now, How Feminists Built an Organization that Transformed America. And in brief, the book is a history of the National Organization for Women, but it tells that story through the lives and activism of three very different women who had much different visions for what that organization could and should be. And so for the purposes of our conversation, I'll mention that one of those protagonists, Patricia Hill Burnett, was a mentee of Betty Friedan and thought very, very highly of her and was completely galvanized and had her life turned around by reading The Feminine Mystique shortly after it came out in the mid-1960s. So looking forward to talking about her life and perspective and how Friedan impacted her, but also millions of other women like her and not so like her. So now I'll turn it over to Rachel, but thanks again for the invitation to be here.
Nate, yeah, thanks so much. The museum is one of my favorite places in Chicago. So I am the author of three previous books. And then this book is Betty Friedan, Magnificent Disruptor. It's being published by Yale University Press, Yale Jewish Lives. It's a series. And I am also a writer. I've written for many magazines and newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. And I am the head and a professor and the head and founder of the Dramaturgy and Criticism Program at the Theater School at DePaul University, which is an undergraduate conservatory for theater arts students.
Great. Yeah, thanks again for both of you for joining me on this. Rachel, maybe we can, for our listeners, with a biography coming out, maybe you can give a brief biography. I mean, I know you wrote a whole book about it, but kind of just to situate Friedan in the
sure.
timeline. And,
sure.
And, you know, yeah.
So a mini biography of Friedan. Friedan was born in 1921 in Peoria, Illinois. So she was a Midwesterner by birth, and she went to school undergrad at Smith College in the late 30s and early 40s. She graduated, she first studied English and then she studied psychology and she graduated in psychology. She did very, very well at school. She was a brilliant student and she then went to Berkeley for 1 year in a graduate program in psychology where she studied with such eminences as Erik Erikson and people like that. But then she dropped out the first year and she left the academy and she moved to New York and she began a career as a writer. First, she wrote for the leftist press, for the radical press. And then as the 40s became the 50s, she switched over to general interest women's magazines. She also, during that time, married and had three children and left the city of New York to move upstate to a suburban community. And so it was during that time in the late 50s when she was living in a gigantic, very gigantic Victorian house in New York State called Ivy's, that she began to work on the feminine mystique, first as a series of articles. She attended her 15th reunion at Smith, and she was chagrined to find that many of the women she went to school with were no longer interested in achieving something giant. They were content with being housewives. So she became very interested in this idea and began to wonder why, you know, why it had happened, how it had happened. And so she started work, as I said, on these articles. And then eventually that became a book. The Feminine Mystique was published in 1963, and it was a bestseller. It made her into a celebrity. It was very controversial, even at the time. It was both admired and criticized early on. For such things as only focusing on white middle-class housewives. That wasn't the exact language of the earliest critiques, but that was the general gist of it, that it did not include Black women or working-class women. But anyway, so it was, as I said, it was an enormous hit, and Betty traveled all over the country talking about it. And she was a really great orator. and people just, she had hit a nerve with the book, and people just loved to hear her talk about it almost as much, or maybe even more than they loved to read it. And so after that, she first started work on a second book, which was about women after the Feminine Mystique, which tried to correct or address some of the criticisms that people had raised. But then, for a variety of reasons, she abandoned that project. And instead, she became involved in the co-founding of the National Organization for Women in 1966. And the National Organization for Women was an independent women's organization. It was the goal of it was to, I'm sure Catherine will correct me and add on to everything I'm saying because she knows way more about it than I do. But the goal of it was to get women of all different classes, backgrounds, et cetera, into a room and to see women as a group and to move forward that way. So it's hard to describe now, looking back on it, the impact that NOW had, although initially it was kind of ignored by the media and or derided by the media. So Betty was the first president of NOW. And NOW immediately dove into all kinds of actions having to do with who could work at which jobs and what kinds of legal restrictions there were around jobs, and also a whole variety. Like, really, they were trying to address every single facet of society. They had many, many different task forces addressing cultural and legal issues. And so, but then almost immediately there were these rifts in NOW. And by 1970, Betty stepped down from being president of NOW. She then went on to do a variety of other things, including co-found the National National Political Women's
National Caucus. National Women's Political Caucus.
Thank you, Katie. National Women's Political Caucus, and many other groups. I mean, she also tried to co-found a women's bank. She also tried to co-found a women's think tank. She was just endlessly. She had endless energy to start all of these initiatives. Some of them failed after a year or less. The National Women's Political Caucus was one of the more successful ones. That was an initiative that was devoted to just legal representation, getting women, represented in government. But then, what else can I say about her? So that brings us up to 1972. I mean, she fell out of the mainstream of the women's movement, and she became more interested in what she called humanism. You know, she thought that the women's movement had gone too far, both in its mainly because of its focus on younger women's focus on sexual politics, what she called bedroom politics. And she didn't want to alienate men. She was very concerned about that. And she didn't want to alienate housewives. She was a middle-class housewife. She was very concerned about that. And so she really diverged from what the women's movement became. And then in the 70s, she also got involved in exposing anti-Semitism in the women's movement. And then... And then at the same time, she was also involved in the enormous push to pass the ERA. But by the early 80s, of course, the ERA did not pass. And the women's movement kind of fell apart, right? I think after there were a lot of years of struggle. I mean, there were a lot of ups and downs. It's interesting because I'm reading about it for something else that I'm working on. I'm rereading about it. And the end of the women's movement was predicted as early as 1970, like, you know, not even four years after NOW had started, people were already saying, oh, this is over. Mm-hmm. What? So it's so outrageous. Anyway, so Betty then wrote a book called her subsequent books are not really considered as important as her first book. And her second book was a collection of essays, and she was very criticized for hogging credit for this founding of the women's movement and various other things. And then her third book was also very criticized because it criticized the women's movement and said that the women's movement had gone too far, and where there had been a feminine mystique, now there was a feminist mystique. And, you know, people who were activists were very angry at Betty, and some still are very angry at Betty. And so she then, she continued to be involved in, I guess what I would say, humanist causes. She continued to fight for women's justice throughout her life. She never stopped doing that. She wrote a book on aging, which I feel did not get the credit it deserved. Yeah, I mean, that about covers it. She died in 2006. That's a kind of messy narrative. Catherine, what did I leave out? I'm sure I left something.
Thing I would add now is that she had the idea for the Women's Strike for Equality in 1970, which that took place actually just well, this won't be released today, but the anniversary is tomorrow, August 26th, 1970, which was a date that she chose because it was the anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which removed sex as a justification for states to deny voting rights. So that Friedan has this idea right as she's stepping down from the leadership of NOW. Or she's gently pushed out of the leadership of NOW, that there should be a big nationwide protest to push for a handful of specific goals related to abortion rights and childcare and workplace rights. And she wants to galvanize a big demonstration in many cities, but she's also intending to bring the movement back a little bit toward what she sees as the real goals, her goals, which are less focused on sexual politics, as Rachel described them so aptly, but more focused on what Betty sees as kind of the core issues of the movement related to women being able to have careers and be independent and have more egalitarian marriages. And so Betty proposes this march at the same conference, in the same speech where she's stepping down from NOW's leadership and handing the reins over to her successor, Eileen Hernandez, who other folks who are in the meeting see her jaw kind of drop or her eyes widen as she realizes she's going to have to fulfill this public promise to create a mass demonstration and an organization that, as Eileen recalled, as she described it, had less than the strength of millions. NOW was still pretty small, but this was in, I think, March 1970, but
yeah, it was March.
After a couple of months of dedicated organization and planning and strategizing, and Betty's deeply involved in this process, it's a huge success. It's demonstrations in more than 40 cities nationwide and at several U.S. embassies overseas. And the priorities that women and men and everyone who shows up at these mass protests far exceed the narrow vision that Betty has for it. And it's why that March for Strike for Women's Equality is generally regarded as the moment when the quote unquote second wave becomes a real mass movement and starts getting serious media coverage. And so certainly Friedan deserves a lot of credit for running with that idea and committing NOW to carrying it out.
Yeah. And just to piggyback on that, I mean, I just would say you it cannot be underestimated how the shock that the other feminists at this meeting in March, when Betty announced this, right? Because what people thought was she was leaving NOW, she was going to give a speech. And then in the descriptions of Betty speaking, it went on for like 2 hours, 3 hours. It's not really clear. There are different versions of it, and she gave this amazingly catalyzing speech about the women's strike. But then, as was typical of her, right, she inspired people and then she stepped back, and at first anyway, and she did not, because, you know, she did not get into, okay, well, how will this actually work? She was great at the idea part, but then later on, when they got back to New York, she did do a good deal of organizing. That's a typical Betty move, right? Is like to come back from like, you've been ejected to boom, no, I'm in the center.
I like that. What you're both of you talking about is a thing I picked up that in your books that I appreciate about your books is that it's to me, at least as I'm reading them, they seemingly like correcting misconceptions or the kind of stereotypical historical views of both NOW and Friedan. And so I guess my question is, what about that, you know, the organization and Friedan herself as a person lent itself to these misconceptions, I guess, or not complete, not whole perceptions of them? And what would you say to correct them, present a more whole picture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very tricky to talk about because Betty was a difficult person, and there are many famous stories about her difficulty, how difficult she was. On the other hand, she was also other things. She was very generous. She could be a very generous friend, particularly to younger women. But she could also be imperious. And, I think a lot of things about this, Nate, honestly, some contradict each other. I also think it's really hard for us in 2023 to think about how at that time saying what Betty was saying, the feminine mystique, which was basically that women are a category deserving of recognition, and they're almost a victimized category deserving of recognition. It's really hard for us to go back in time to the late 50s and to think about how sensational, how controversial that was. I mean, it really, if you listen to radio shows from that time or early TV shows, if you watch early TV shows with Betty on them, what you see is it's just like people, you know, some of them had their knives out to get her, you know, it was too much for people to hear. And so I think in part because of that, in part because of things having to do with her childhood, she had a kind of difficult childhood growing up in a very conformist town in southern Illinois. I think she developed these strategies for being an individual. That was one of the things that she valued the most. It was being an individual, living up to her fullest potential. I mean, she was very committed to those ideals, which she had not really received any support, despite being this brilliant student at Smith and so on. And I just think she had to fight her entire life. And so I think she got used to or developed these ways of speaking that were not always like what we think of as, I don't know, acceptable speech, acceptable ways of speaking now. Mm-hmm. Like yelling or whatever. I mean, like a famous story is one day, I think it was like in the late 80s, she was at a dinner party at her brother's house and someone asked her, "Betty, can you tell us about the feminist movement?" And she just like slapped the person down. She was just like, "No, I won't do," you know. And later when she and her brother were walking back to the car, he said, "Betty, why were you so rude to that person? You know, I've been to your house a lot of times and I was never rude to anybody at your house." And she said, "Harry, there aren't any idiots at my house." I mean, that was typical, you know. I mean, she really, and you know, so I have very mixed feelings about all this. Like I'm trying to imagine myself like, you know, for somebody to, I don't know, Catherine, what you feel about this, but like for somebody to ask, like in the 1980s, "Betty, can you explain what the feminist movement?" I mean, she may have thought like, "Where the hell have you been for 20 years or something?" Right. Like that. I refuse to answer this. I mean, that is a kind of older way of dealing with this kind of, you know, with the kind of questioning. I think a more, you know, a more 21st century way is to, you know, bring the person along or whatever. But so, yeah, I mean, I tried really hard in my book to draw like a middle line of just not necessarily defending, but understanding why did she do certain things? Yeah. Why did she act in a certain way?
Good. And from my perspective, correcting misconceptions or sort of filling in the picture, it's really fun to be in conversation with Betty Friedan's biographer. And Friedan, of course, deserves an updated biography with the sensitive treatment that Rachel will bring to it. But one of the main misconceptions I want to clear up with my book, The Women of Now, is that Betty Friedan was not now. That oftentimes in popular memory and even some scholarship, Friedan and her cohort of mostly professional, mostly middle class women with careers are sort of attributed as what now began as and what now always was. And if you actually spend the time in Now's archive and look at the organization through a longer lens, its whole trajectory, you see that not only were there lots of different women there from the beginning, that Now was always intended as an organization, as a coalition, as a united force of women, that many of the founders, including Friedan, were not that involved with Now after, I don't know, a handful of years. Maybe for Friedan, she's less involved after 1970. So my book really highlights the women of color who were there, the lesbians who were there, the working class women who were there, to show the range of backgrounds that at this mid-1960s moment, often galvanized somewhat by the feminine mystique. We should certainly talk about that book's impact, but that book hit many different women in a profound way for different reasons. And women, the founders of Now, many of them were already involved in different kinds of organizations in the labor movement and the civil rights movement. Many had spent decades in male-led institutions like colleges and universities, mm-hmm. the church, labor unions, the civil rights movement. And so the secret to now's success, to the extent that it succeeded, was actually not that it was founded by elite individuals or prominent individuals such as Friedan, but that it had structures that could endure and that it was an appealing idea to a broad range of women. And I would also say, I mean, I think it's another reason it feels really fruitful to be in conversation with Rachel and to be telling these stories right now is that women and their organizations deserve to be recovered and remembered in all their complexity. I think neither of our books offers simple answers about what happened and why, or characterizes now or Friedan in simplified terms, because for the same reason that we have, you know, 1,000-page biographies of great men in our society and long and detailed histories of other kinds of organizations and their cultural impact and their struggles and their accomplishments, women and their organizations deserve the same nuanced, sensitive, in-depth treatment. So that was certainly, you know, the book tells the story of now in all its complexity and the accomplishments and the frustrations and the things that maybe look obvious to us from 2023 looking back, but that the folks who were there in 1970-something maybe didn't see in the same way or didn't understand the conflicts, some of which were kind of intractable, but others got resolved in ways that we might wish had gone a different way. But I think it's important to recover all of those stories. And that's the historian's job, is to bring complexity to light, bring different perspectives to light, and help the reader understand what different figures and institutions were up against in different moments and how things got complicated and how they got worked out.
Yeah, and that's really, I just agree with that 100%. And I don't know how you feel about this, Katie, but I think women have not gotten that same kind of treatment as male figures, or they're held to some different standard in general. Like, I can't really think of that many 1,000-page biographies of women, for example, whereas I can think of several of men. And I also think that when it comes down to this question of complexity, I do think that male figures who are, you know, whatever arena, whatever realm they are coming from, I do think that they get a kind of more generous perspective. And I don't know if you agree with that or not, but
yeah. And I also think, you know, maybe to bring our conversation back to the feminine mystique, if we could, I mean, if that book had not been as resonant, as beautifully written, as timely as it was, it would never have been so controversial. I mean, maybe you disagree, Rachel, but that book really mattered to people, and mm-hmm. all different people saw themselves in it or mm-hmm. wanted to see themselves in it and mm-hmm. wanted it to be what, you know, a little bit more of what they wanted. And certainly the criticisms of that book are valid from different perspectives. We could talk about that. But if that book hadn't reached so many people who saw themselves in it and were galvanized to action, either within their families or their personal relationships or their schools or workplaces or broader activism, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I do agree.
Yeah. What about that writing specifically lent itself to that, would you say? Like you said, the timing was right for one thing, in that 1963, correct?
Yeah, 1963.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are a couple of things. I think one is, as I said in my messy biography, Betty was a product of the academy. I mean, in other words, she had started to get a PhD in psychology. And then she had been educated at an extremely sophisticated level at Smith. And, but then she abandoned that and went into radical journalism, as I said, writing about the Jim Crow South and many other things. And then wrote general interest stories for general interest women's magazines, some of which are quite a bit more radical in their drafts than they were in the finished version, as was the Feminine Mystique. But I think, you know, one thing, obviously the sweep of the language, as Katie was saying, but also Betty really used some scholarly methods, but then she tried to marry those to narrative journalistic techniques.
Okay.
Sometimes with, depending on who you ask, is more or less successful. But I mean, that was the marriage. You know, she wanted to really tell a story. One of her inspirations was John Hershey's New Yorker series on Hiroshima. Yeah, which is like a very granular narrative history of how six people were affected by the bomb. And she was very affected by that. And I think that influenced her. She also, even in her earliest days as a radical journalist, she was very, very interested in the detective form. And she was constantly like kind of casting herself as a detective or even a kind of scientist Monkey or you know, some individual who was going through the weeds. And then I guess a third thing is that she also, in the telling of the story of the feminine mystique, she makes herself a character, not just as this detective figure, but also as somebody who contributed to the feminine mystique and lived it, right? So she both cast herself in the role of a housewife and who lived it, and she also talks about how in various meetings with editors and so on, she tried to accommodate to their ideas of what it was specifically that female readers would want. So, but by doing that, by telling that story, she, you know, it's a kind of, yes, it's my fault too. It's my fault too. That's a very seductive way of telling a story in nonfiction. So I would say that to me, those three things are things that she tried to do in The Feminine Mystique, which partly account for it becoming this wild bestseller.
Well, and I can add a little bit about just the early 1960s context when that book came out. I think it's hard to, might be hard for us in 2023 to put ourselves in the mindset or imagine being in the context of the early 1960s when sexism, of course, intertwined with racism and heterosexism and classism, was so pervasive and unpunished and casualized in American culture, to say nothing of the way that it was institutionalized in American law. Job advertisements were segregated by sex, and there were laws in every state that required employers to treat women differently precisely because of sex. If you picked up an advice manual for women in the early 60s, you would be told that the way to behave in a marriage is to be a child, to be girlish, to subordinate yourself to your husband, certainly to find a husband first, which of course was not that appealing to many, many women, but that was the way to be an adult woman, to subordinate yourself to him, to subordinate any needs or desires or ambitions that you had to the male figure in your life. So I think that Frieda, I did identify a kind of problem that many women faced or felt, but didn't quite know how to articulate, or who believed this was a problem in their own lives, that they had grown up in the 1950s, which, you know, sort of rigid time in terms of gender roles, but also a kind of optimistic time, optimism about American progress and promise. The democracy had triumphed over fascism and Nazism. Americans were having babies at record rates. There's a sense of optimism and maybe also a sense of belief in the American dream and the power of democracy. Of course, this is before Watergate, before Americans start to turn on the Vietnam War and identify it for what it was. So a kind of mismatch, perhaps, that many women felt for different reasons, but mismatch between what the messages they received, both about how to be a woman and how great their country was, how many opportunities, how many, you know, just paths are available to Americans to define their own lives, the contrast between that optimism and what many women felt were the realistic possibilities open to them. And that kind of tension was quite difficult to live with, let alone resolve. And I think Friedan's book gave many women a language and a new frame for understanding how they felt, and just galvanized a lot of people, transformed many people.
Would you say, like, you know, gave the readers, well, like you just said, yeah, words that to describe feelings that they had maybe not understood fully, but we're of course feeling that those tensions. It's interesting that Rachel, you said too, I like the detective story aspect and integrating both the kind of the psychology of it. I imagine some scientific language kind of merging that with a voice and a style that is easily accessible, right?
I mean, there's quite a lot of science in the feminine mystique. I mean, there's quite a lot of studies discussed and et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, it can be in different places. I mean, I feel very close to some parts of it, and then other parts of it, I am sort of less, I don't know, interested in or something like that. And I think many people feel that way. I think people have their favorite parts of the book.
Yeah, and I think it's important to put some of the main criticisms of the book on the table too. Frieda Ann identifies this, what she calls this problem that has no name, essentially that when women start to feel frustrations or feel that their ambitions are stifled, their individuality is stifled, that all the messages they receive tell them to just channel that frustration and that ambition into their keeping up their homes, taking care of their husbands, and looking after their children, so that women are not supposed to be their own independent people. And one of the solutions that Frieda Ann prescribes at the end of the book is for women to develop what she calls a new life plan. And that has to do with asserting themselves in the public sphere, whether that's entering a career, volunteering full time, getting involved in politics, becoming individuals out in sort of public, and then sort of strengthening their marriages as a result, because they become more independent people. But of course, she doesn't address who's going to do that housework when these women are, you know, who's going to pick up the slack in people's homes when they're now like out in society. And of course, it's not a message that speaks directly to women who have always worked. So women of color, working class women who never had the luxury to be housewives, even if they aspired to that kind of role. And so, and Rachel, you were mentioning earlier that Frieda Ann, she heard those critiques and she intended to address them in a second volume, which she never wrote because she was busy organizing women and engaged in activism.
Yes. Yes, that was my one of my findings from the archives, was that she, you know, if this other book had been published, I wonder if her reception today would be different. Because I agree with you, of course, that as it stands now, the book can seem exclusive, not inclusive, but certainly. Certainly, as we already said, that it was criticized for that almost immediately by Gerda Lerner and others. Lerner was not the only one. There were other scholars immediately saying, wait a minute. So people were onto it from the beginning. I think the language against it over time has gotten much harsher. Perhaps that's to be expected. We live in harsher times in some ways.
Rachel, do you think this question just occurs to me, do you think she could have written, do you think the book could have been just as powerful with just as strong and clear of a voice if she had written it the way that her 21st century critics or even her 1965 era critics, because part of what makes the book so powerful is its focus. She's really speaking directly to, I mean, she doesn't qualify it, but she's speaking to a cohort of middle-class women, especially white women. I don't know. I wonder if the book would have had the same impact, or wouldn't have drawn the same criticism, but could it have done as much as it did do if she had written it in a way we might wish from our 21st century perspective?
I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. I just know that reading the notes from that other book was enormously inspiring and in some way heartened me to think, oh, wow, she went and interviewed, you know, women who worked at NASA. She went and interviewed cleaning women, and you know, I mean, she really like attacked it, and I don't know, it made me wonder why. One of the things I think is she never did not really, from my perspective, during her lifetime, she didn't really publicly address the criticisms as, I don't know, deftly as she might have. So I don't know. I guess it's just me, her biographer, wanting maybe a more neat wrap up than actually exists.
Yeah, in your biography, I found it interesting. I think it was maybe in the epilogue you mentioned that she was no saint. You say that a couple times, but also that she would probably get canceled today, and you know, in our cancel culture, quote unquote. And yeah, so I don't know, that's just, I found that to be interesting. And I wonder why. Do you think you mentioned it a little bit earlier, but was it her kind of abrasiveness or?
Okay. I mean, I think there's two things. There's one, her character is one thing. And then I think, you know, there's the book. And I think in addition to what Katie was talking about earlier, in terms of who specifically the book was written to address, who it was talking about, there's also specific issues of language. And so she uses this very larger than life language in certain things. I'll give you an example. Like there's one chapter, I think it's chapter 12, the comfortable concentration camp is a phrase that she uses to describe suburban housewives trapped, you know, in their split level houses, in their subdivisions. And you know, that's very, from our perspective, even then it was considered very explosive, but today it's beyond, it's people, I don't think people can accept it. I think, you know, there's different, I mean, I could go on about my theories and others' theories about why did she use this sort of language? I've talked about that a little bit, but I think that's the kind of thing that would get her canceled as much as her character, which is really a separate issue. I think one of the things, if you're writing a biography, it's, you know, today, I think it's very hard for people to separate the person from the work, which when I was a student was like a huge thing. Okay, the person is not the work. We, you know, that was drilled into us. And I think today, I think there's a different, you know, a different thought about that. I think the person is the work. That's the thought. I don't know, Katie, maybe you have a different view about this. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because the work, right, the feminine mystique was what made Frida Ann a celebrity, which was what convinced, like Starting Now was not her idea. It came out of women, especially Black women in the labor movement. It came from women working in government who saw that the government officials who were supposed to be interpreting and enforcing new provisions for sex equality were not doing their job. And this sort of underground network in DC identified Frida Ann as someone who would have the notoriety, but also the independence to be the figurehead of a new organization. And this is just 3 years after the Feminine Mystique is published that now is founded. They knew after spending time with Frida Ann that she probably didn't have the right personality or the administrative skills that you would need to run an organization, especially as it grew. I mean, in terms of the language though, I think it's also important to put on the table some of her comments about lesbians, some of her, whom she infamously called a lavender menace. She was very concerned about, she really wanted to make sure that men were prominent in Now. She was perhaps at the leading edge within that organization of making sure that men were not only members of Now, but were prominent leaders in the organization to signal to other men, but to the rest of American society that feminism was not radical, that it was not alienating, that it was not scary, that it was not, you know, too far beyond the pale for middle class Americans coming from families like she came from to accept. She did cause a lot of pain for women who were queer, women who were closeted, who wanted to be part of a women's organization, who perhaps weren't fully out or didn't feel comfortable being out in an activist group, who wanted to work through Now. And she eventually apologized for saying that. So I think maybe this comes back to what we were saying before about acknowledging the complexity that we can understand why she said what she said and what was motivating her when she made those comments. But we need to understand Frida Ann's humanity and her motives and sort of hold that intention or, you know, in tandem with the impact that her words have. And of course, it all comes back to the feminine mystique, because if she had not written that best-selling book, she wouldn't have had the prominence to lead Now, and she wouldn't have had to develop the thick skin and the fearlessness, honestly, that she showed in traveling the country, organizing all those early chapters, putting herself out there, and doing a lot of important work for the movement. So it's, she's many things at once.
Yeah.
I mean, she, just to add to that, I mean, she herself knew that she was not well suited to run now, you know, and she did not, she says in several different places that she did not want to take it on, but yet she did. And yeah, Katie, I remember reading, I mean, there are several places where some of those labor women just talk about like her atrocious temper and that sort of thing.
Or coming out of the labor movement, right? You understand that you have to actually work with people, that you have to broker consensus, that you have to run meetings, that you have to, has to kind of subordinate their own individual goals and personalities to the broader whole. But that was not, Betty is a freelance journalist. That is not her experience.
Well, she was a freelance.
Oh, right. That's right. But she did work with the labor press, but was she anyway?
I was going to say that, but also like from earliest childhood, like developing her individuality was key to, imagining who she could be. So there was no way she could have ever, Katie, done what you're talking about. Do you know what I mean? She just, that was beyond her, completely beyond her. Like it was beyond herself.
Yeah. And it gave her a kind of confidence and fearlessness to endure all kinds of slings and arrows. I think about the kind of misogyny and just vitriol that an outspoken woman, especially a middle-aged woman who aged very prominently in public, right? She lives, you mentioned her life. She lives at least into her 80s, maybe her 90s. And she's a public figure. And so I think part of the story of Friedan is that she remains very prominent. She remains a public figure, and successive generations of feminists come up after her, and she is often a very useful foil or a useful target.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. I think of her, she's the thing that we take our temperature by.
How are we doing now? Where are we now?
we're not doing that well, Kate.
Not great. That leads me to another question. I was like, in your epilogue, Rachel, you kind of talk about this, about kind of guessing about how Friedan would be engaging with our current world. And so, yeah, it's all pure conjecture, but I'm curious to hear what you both think, how she would be, would she be on Twitter or the platform formerly known as Twitter?
Maybe she wanted to be involved, you know, she continued to want to be involved until basically the end. I mean, she...
Right. She was working tirelessly.
She worked. That was just so key to her identity. She did not want to stop, even after really she was no longer able to, you know, give these talks. I mean, she just pushed forward and she was ill also. And but I do want to say, I think, she really, the advice that she gave young women was take risks. And I think that's solid advice for anyone now, for any young woman now. What else do I think she would, I mean, I think she would still be trying to fight for women. I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think she would still be telling hard truths from her perspective that would resonate with a lot of people and might anger or alienate a lot of others. But, it's hard to argue against the idea that the Feminine Mystique was an incredibly productive and generative text. And Friedan remained a generative and polarizing figure. And I think she would still be that. She would be telling hard-boiled truths about all of the misogyny that remains in our world. She would probably be pretty angry about a lot of the backsliding that we've seen with gender-based rights. And I hope, I guess I hope other groups of women would have gotten to her and convinced her to expand her lens and expand her feminism, as many of us have, right? So she continued to be learning and growing and using her incredible ability to put words, powerful words on the page and apply her analytical apparatus to the world around her. Like, we can always use someone who can do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. As we're getting towards the end here, we've been talking a lot about the Feminine Mystique. And as we talked earlier, prior to the conversation, you both have some passages that you'd like to read from it. I would love to hear those. And and if you want to, contextualize them at all or anything, feel free to do so. But Katie, I think yours were from, yeah, you can start us off.
Yes, thank you. So this is, these are just a few paragraphs from the beginning of The Feminine Mystique, the very first chapter, which is titled The Problem That Has No Name. And I often teach this chapter. I find it so haunting, this description of what life was like for many white middle-class women in suburbia in the 1950s. And I think students of many different backgrounds can see themselves in it, or see their mothers or their grandmothers in it. And I still think it's so resonant. The problem lay buried, unspoken, for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone as she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask, even of herself, the silent question, is this all? For over 15 years, there was no word of this yearning in the millions of words written about women, for women, in all the columns, books, and articles by experts telling women their role was to seek fulfillment as wives and mothers. They were taught to pity the neurotic, unfeminine, unhappy women who wanted to be poets or physicists or presidents. They learned that truly feminine women do not want careers, higher education, political rights, the independence and the opportunities that the old-fashioned feminists fought for. Some women in their 40s and 50s still remembered painfully giving up those dreams, but most of the younger women no longer even thought about them. 1,000 expert voices applauded their femininity, their adjustment, their new maturity. All they had to do was devote their lives from the earliest girlhood to finding a husband and bearing children. The suburban housewife, she was the dream image of the young American women and the envy, it was said, of women all over the world. The American housewife, freed by science and labor-saving appliances from the drudgery, the dangers of childbirth, and the illnesses of her grandmother. She was healthy, beautiful, educated, concerned only about her husband, her children, her home. She had found true feminine fulfillment. As a housewife and mother, she was respected as a full and equal partner to man in his world. She was free to choose automobiles, clothes, appliances, supermarkets. She had everything women had ever dreamed of. In the 15 years after World War II, this mystique of feminine fulfillment became the cherished and self-perpetuating core of contemporary American culture. Millions of women lived their lives in the image of those pretty pictures of the American suburban housewife, kissing their husbands goodbye in front of the picture window, depositing their station wagons full of children at school, and smiling as they ran the new electric waxer over the spotless kitchen floor. Their only dream was to be perfect wives and mothers. Their highest ambition to have 5 children and a beautiful house, their only fight to get and keep husbands. They had no thought for the unfeminine problems of the world outside the home. They wanted the men to make the major decisions. They gloried in their role as women and wrote proudly on the census blank, occupation, housewife. If a woman had a problem in the 1950s and 60s, she knew that something must be wrong with her marriage or herself. Other women were satisfied with their lives, she thought. What kind of a woman was she if she did not feel this mysterious fulfillment waxing the kitchen floor? She was so ashamed to admit her dissatisfaction that she never knew how many other women shared it. If she tried to tell her husband, he didn't understand what she was talking about. She did not really understand it herself.
Thank you for that. That goes to what we were saying. Yeah, she did not understand it herself until that book came out, right? And haunting is a good word to describe that passage as well. Rachel, did you want to share?
Yes. I'm going to read from the end, the very last section of the book, which many people feel is very moving. And this is just 3 paragraphs. In the light of women's long battle for emancipation, the recent sexual counter-revolution in America has been perhaps a final crisis, a strange breath-holding interval before the larva breaks out of the shell into maturity, a moratorium during which many millions of women put themselves on ice and stopped growing. They say that one day science will be able to make the human body live longer by freezing its growth. American women lately have been living much longer than men, walking through their leftover lives like living dead women. Perhaps men may live longer in America when women carry more of the burden of the battle with the world instead of being a burden themselves. I think their wasted energy will continue to be destructive to their husbands, to their children, and to themselves until it is used in their own battle with the world. But when women, as well as men, emerge from biological living to realize their human selves, those leftover halves of life may become their years of greatest fulfillment. Then the split in the image will be healed, and daughters will not face that jumping off point at 21 or 41. When their mother's fulfillment makes girls sure they want to be women, they will not have to beat themselves down to be feminine. They can stretch and stretch until their own efforts will tell them who they are. They will not need the regard of a boy or man to feel alive. And when women do not need to live through their husbands and children, men will not fear the love and strength of women, nor need another's weakness to prove their masculinity. They can finally see each other as they are, and this may be the next step in human evolution. Who knows what women can be when they are finally free to become themselves? Who knows what women's intelligence will contribute when it can be nourished without denying love? Who knows of the possibilities of love when men and women share not only children, home and garden, not only the fulfillment of their biological roles, but the responsibilities and passions of the work that creates the human future and the full human knowledge of who they are. It has barely begun, the search of women for themselves, but the time is at hand when the voices of the feminine mystique can no longer drown out the inner voice that is driving women on to become complete.
Very good. How do you follow that up? Yeah, that, I like that you bookended that as well, reading from the beginning and end of the book. Well, thank you both. Was there anything that we didn't cover yet that either of you wanted to talk about?
Katie, I want to ask you about something. I mean, totally hearing you about the pain that Friedan caused lesbians with the phrase "the Lavender Menace," and then you mentioned her infamous or famous apology in 1977. Mm-hmm. At the Houston Women's Conference. But I wonder, I would love to get your take on this. I mean, from being in the archives, even after that, for years, really almost until Friedan's death, women would come up to her and ask her, hey, you know, you were the one who used the phrase, the Lavender Menace. Mm-hmm. And I think she at times would become very angry, you know, that people were still like remembering this. Mm-hmm. She felt that this was the thing that people were going to remember mm-hmm. about her. So she would sometimes erupt, you know, when some young, like if she spoke at a university and some young woman raised their hand and said, you know, 20 years ago, Mrs. Friedan or whatever, Ms. Friedan, you did this. I mean, what is your take on that? I don't know. What do you feel that that's, I don't know, I guess I'm asking you, is there a timeline on harm? Maybe there is, maybe that's a dumb question, right?
A statute of limitations. I mean, I was at NOW's 50th anniversary conference in 2016, and there were women who knew Friedan in that late 60s moment in NOW, you know, who were lesbians, who were younger, who admired Friedan and really saw her as the leader.
Right.
And she did discourage out lesbians from taking leadership roles in NOW or from coming out in NOW. And, you know, I think it's, your work is really important, Rachel, in understanding what was motivating Friedan to say those things. And, but the pain was still
there
decades later. And so I would come back to the point that if Friedan had not written such a powerful book, if she had not had such a prominent role in feminism in that late 60s, early 70s moment, you know, she wouldn't have had that remark reprinted in the New York Times, and she wouldn't have had it tagged to her for decades to come.
Right.
I mean, I think it's important to understand how fragile the movement felt to folks like Friedan and her cohort in the late 1960s. And she was not the only one among the leaders of NOW in the late 1960s who were really trying to put a damper on any mention of lesbianism, who did not want to affirm a lesbian rights resolution, which the organization does anyway in 1971. So it wasn't just Betty. But as women are coming to NOW and building chapters and eventually doing consciousness raising through NOW, but certainly like having conversations with other women in NOW and talking about the problems in their lives and wanting to be authentic and open in themselves, women do start coming to NOW and coming out in NOW and seeing a contradiction between, you know, maybe being a little bit closeted or buttoned up on their job or at school and bringing that same approach to NOW. They want to be open in themselves. And so there's a kind of organic process that happens in NOW, at least in many of the chapters in the late 60s, where women start to come out in NOW. And so it's somewhat of a generational tension, but it does erupt in 1971 when the organization overwhelmingly affirms, this lesbian rights. And some folks expected Friedan to oppose it, but she didn't. She didn't speak out.
No. In fact, I write about that in the book, what happened when she went to the the NOW conference that year. But that NOW conference, if you may know, got very little coverage in the New York Times, for example, where, you know, like it was like the Times dropped it. You know, the meeting kind of dropped NOW. But I'm not saying that's connected necessarily. Anyway, Katie, I just was wondering, because, you know, this is something I obviously think about a lot. And as you know, Friedan's own defense was, as you said, she was very concerned that about the fragility of the women's movement.
Yeah. But I guess I would also say, though, that there were a lot of other straight women in NOW including her mentee, Patricia Hill Burnett, who was a prosperous housewife in Detroit and, you know, just idolized Friedan. I would say there were many more women in NOW who, when confronted with this question of what is the place of lesbians in the movement, what is the place of lesbian rights on our agenda, were not as rigid, negative and rigid as Friedan was. I think that resolution never would have passed if more women in NOW had the same reaction that Friedan did. And I think what I found in my research was that what was more typical was women open to the idea, curious about the idea, intrigued that they had already met lesbians through NOW, but they didn't, those women were not out. And so Friedan was really on one end of a spectrum of reactions to, maybe a further end of the spectrum would be the handful of women who quit NOW over that issue. But Friedan was close to one side of a spectrum of responses within NOW to the question of lesbian women and lesbian rights. And I mean, I do think it's important to understand why she did what she did, but I also think it's important to point out that that was not the only possible response from her. You know, she had information at hand. She knew, you know, she realistically, it's unfair to hold people accountable when they, you know, when they had no access to information, you know, you know what I'm saying? It's like, she could, I think realistically, she could have taken a different approach to that issue. So I do think it's important to point out what she did and why.
Yeah. Well, I don't think she could have taken a different approach than she did because of who she was, right?
I mean, I see what you're saying. Okay. You know well, this, like, is, her, this is the importance, think, of a biographer versus a historian.
Yeah. I mean,
of
I think her, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think like her past made it impossible, you know, for her to have a different, as much as we would want her to or whatever. Yeah. I just think she was not, I mean, first of all, as we've said, she deeply believed that the movement would fall apart if you know, what she considered to be special interest groups were, you know, allowed to whatever flourish or dominate. But then just her own, I don't know, everything had gone into this one thing, you know, in her own identity, in the creation of her own identity.
This is interesting. I mean, so maybe this is one, we've been talking about how visionary Friedan was and what a leader in many ways, but I mean, would you agree that she was not correct in that assessment? Because the place of lesbians in the movement moves much closer to the center, and lesbian feminism flourishes. And you know, by 1977, the movement is much more robust. And I'm thinking about the National Women's Conference. There are all different subsets of women at that conference. And so maybe this is one area where Friedan was overly paranoid or was not.
She was paranoid, certainly, as many people were then. But I also think, I mean, I don't know. I have sort of mixed ambivalent feelings about it. I mean, you know more about the history of the movement. I mean, I feel like we've made enormous strides in terms of people's individual freedom, but not in terms of like equality, the equalities, the sort of mundane equalities that were being discussed initially. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe you don't feel that way.
I mean, I guess
I feel like the focus is all on identity. Do you disagree?
But I mean, if Friedan in the Feminine Mystique, Friedan intends to imagine women as a class and free women as a class, like a lot of that is about individual, like you read that book is a lot about individual liberation. And mm-hmm. once you encourage people to liberate themselves individually and live more authentically, how can you then turn around and say, oh no, not like that. So it's the yeah. paradox that we're all yeah. individuals, but we're also members of larger groups. And we yeah. have a certain amount of agency in our lives, but we're also subject to structural forces that long predate us and will probably outlive us. Although, you know, lots of movements are trying to make things better.
Right. I mean, I just mean like things like equal pay and the second shift, like those are still things that we're grappling with. Whereas I do many, many strides have been made in like lesbian and gay rights, for example, mm-hmm. but they have not been made in equal pay and the second shift. Do you agree with that?
I hear what you're saying. That's really interesting. I mean, so yeah. Friedan was really onto something in terms of imagining women as a class and thinking about women as a class who have to fight back as a class. And that's yeah. what's motivating now too, that's, but yeah. maybe she needed a more flexible vision of like mm. what that coalition could be and yeah. who got to be themselves openly, fully and completely in that coalition.
Yeah, I mean, she couldn't have that for all the reasons that we've been discussing. But I agree with you that if she had had that, perhaps we would have all that we want.
Well, you know, we've talked about this, Rachel. It's like what Friedan was trying to do and what Now was trying to do was really hard. How do mm-hmm. you take on patriarchy as a white heteropatriarchy is a hundreds mm-hmm. and hundreds of years old and so deeply entrenched everywhere in American life, institutions, law, culture, you name it. So I always remind my students, like, we can certainly criticize and we should and analyze what individual people did in their groups, but let's also understand the scale of what they were up against and what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important. Thank you. Yeah, and thank you both, Rachel and Katie, for joining me on this.
This was terrific.
Yeah. One more time, let us hear about your books. And listeners, there are links in the episode description to get the books. So Katie, why don't you tell us a little bit about yours again?
Sure. So my book is called The Women of Now, How Feminists Built an Organization that Transformed America, published in August 2023 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And it looks at three different, very different women who became leaders of Now from the late 1960s through the late 70s and 80s, and looks at how different women aspired to work together through the same open-ended organization to pursuing different sort of strands of feminism in coalition, and how different visions of feminism kind of came to fruition, but also fell apart. And yes, the book is an organizational history told through the lives and activism of three specific women.
Great. Thank you. And Rachel?
And my book is Betty Friedan, Magnificent Disruptor. It's a biography of Betty Friedan.
Great. Thank you again for joining me on this. And I hope you have a great day.
Nate, thank you so much. And Katie, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Nate and Rachel. This was terrific. I'm what a pleasure to be in conversation with you both.
Yes. Thanks. Have a nice weekend.
Yes. Take care, everybody. Thanks again, Nate. Bye. This was great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.